So, A, with initial onset, with normal doses, before the diuresis really begins, you have fluid overload. So that's what you need to worry about. Now, what would happen if you had a patient that didn't have congestive heart failure and they were just going in, they'd say they were mildly hypertensive? Would you worry about a little bit of fluid excess? Not at all. So obviously, it's the situation for the patient that is important here. What about the second question? D? D is in dog. Acetazolamide forms acid, so it's acidotic. The first three are all loop diuretics. Loops cause alkalosis, as does E-hydrochlorothiazide. All right. Yes, ma'am. Say that again. Acetazolamide will exacerbate the acidosis on dosing. You laughed at me already this morning. Okay. Pass those in, please. Okay, so I think we're talking about gout this morning. Gout is a rather painful disorder. Let's see, wrong one. These pictures aren't the best. But I think it's pretty obvious when you look at it. This is a situation with acute gout. You can see the swelling that's present. In terms of chronic gout, you can have the accumulation of urate crystals within a joint. Here's a tremendous amount of accumulation here. Here's an elbow that's beginning to have deposition of, or the formation of tophi, which is the accumulation of urate crystals. Here we've got chronic gout with tophi in all of these joints. And you can imagine trying to move those things with that kind of irritant being present. So when we think of uric acid, how does the kidney take care of it? Well, as the handout says, it's freely filtered by the glomerulus. It gets into the, it's both reabsorbed and secreted in the proximal tubule. With increased urinary excretion, the size of the urate pool in the body will decrease, but plasma concentrations will stay the same. So you can measure plasma urate all you want to, and you're not going to get a change when you put the patient on drug therapy. So as long as you've got tophi present and any uric acid deposited in joints, you've got to move that out of the joint back into the bloodstream in an equilibrium type situation, and the body can get rid of it through the kidney, and all that's got to get eliminated before you'll begin to see changes in plasma urate concentration. Okay. If you think about treating a patient that's got tophi, you want to get rid of it. You're dealing with a chronic gout situation. There are a lot of ways to do that. And one of the ways is to deal with the kidney. How might you enhance elimination of uric acid? You say, well, you could just give fluid, and maybe fluid and some electrolytes, and you just push it out. And in actuality, that's not bad. Most therapists will tell you, you need to be drinking how much water a day? So say eight 8-ounce glasses of water a day, that's 64 ounces. Anybody know what 64 ounces is equivalent to? A gallon. Okay, so just put a gallon in front of the patient and say, fill it and drink it every day. Now, how many of you drink anywhere near close to that? Okay, some of you are very good. All I know is when I was passing that stone and had to drink a gallon of water a day, it was hard. I just don't do it. But this one way, you could get rid of some urate. And why? Why? Dilute the concentration in the tubular lumen, you effectively enhance secretion out. But another way of playing around with it is you could end up using uricosuric drugs. What are uricosuric drugs? Well, the first one on the list is probenecid. Probenecid is a uricosuric agent. It competes with uric acid for reabsorption by the proximal tubular cells. Now, the trouble with probenecid is it also competes at the level of secretion. So on initial dosing, if it competes at the level of secretion, it will decrease secretion. What's going to happen? Levels in the bloodstream won't change. You can't measure a difference, but there's more urate that's present to go someplace into the tissues. So you can actually trigger an acute gouty attack when you initiate probenecid therapy. As the dose rises and you reach essentially steady state in the plasma, then you end up with the major effect, which is an inhibition on the reabsorption. And so the urate will stay in the tubular lumen. So probenecid's a nice drug for chronic gout. If you want to get rid of these tophi, the accumulation of these uric acid crystals. When you think about gout, you might say this has got to be an incredibly painful disease. Most patients do complain about it. When uric acid is in the joints, one of the things that happens is phagocytes come in and try to absorb it. They dump it into the lysosomes to try to break it down. They can't. It ends up killing the phagocytes. Then what happens? You dump mediators of inflammation. So you get the release of things like, I don't know, interleukin-1. You can talk about other things. Leukotrienes, prostaglandins, other things that would trigger an inflammatory type response. So as long as you've got extra uric acid floating around and getting into joints, you get a very nasty situation. Probenecid is great for chronic gout when you're trying to move it out of these joints and out of the body. But it can trigger an acute gouty attack on initial therapy. There's some side effects listed there. One that I probably should have put down was GI upset. The next drug in the list is similar to probenecid. It's sulfapyrazone. It too is a uricosuric drug, so it's acting via the kidney. It's more potent than is probenecid. It readily inhibits tubular reabsorption. Again, chronic gout would be treated with sulfapyrazone, because it can facilitate the removal of those crystals out of the body. There are drug interactions, as with probenecid. Think about it. It works at the level of organic anion secretion in the proximal tubule. So how many things are you aware of that use that organic anion transport system? We've talked about things like warfarin, we've talked about verapamil, we've talked about some diuretics that have to use it to get in. So there are lots and lots of drug interactions at this level. But probenecid and sulfapyrazone then could be used in the treatment of chronic gout. Another area for drug therapy is going to be with your nonsteroidal anti-inflams. And in the spring, we'll spend more time on these guys. So right now, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on them. We're kind of working on the kidney. But when you think about it, endomethacin is probably the mainstay of the anti-inflammatory drugs. You can use other agents. And basically what endomethacin is doing is it's preventing the formation of mediators of inflammation, so your leukotrienes and your prostaglandins. These guys are reversible inhibitors of cyclooxygenase, so anything that's going through that pathway is going to be inhibited. But we'll talk more about that class of drugs later. Another agent that's used, this time in acute gout now, can be colchicine. So non-steroidals can be used in both acute and chronic gout. I guess that's important at this point. The next group of drugs, colchicine, is for acute gout. This is an agent that decreases leukocyte migration. It decreases the phagocytic process. It's also an inhibitor of tubulin function, microtubule assembly. And so it has nasty hepatotoxic responses. It affects canalicular secretion, if you will, of bile. It also affects some kidney function. So it's got some significant toxicity associated with it, which is why it's limited to acute gouty attacks. Other side effects, GI upset, diarrhea. But the major concern is with the hepatic and renal toxicity. Then the final drug in the list that's worth considering is allopurinol. This goes back to biochem. You remember the pathway for the metabolism of purines? Okay, so purines go to hypoxanthine, hypoxanthine to uric acid. Xanthine oxidase is the enzyme that does the conversions. So if you inhibit xanthine oxidase, you prevent the conversion of hypoxanthine to uric acid, if you will. So what do we got? Hypoxanthine is soluble, it's readily excreted. So an inhibitor of xanthine oxidase is useful. Allopurinol is it. It can include some problems with GI upset, rare blood dyscrasias. So allopurinol can be used in both acute and chronic gout, primarily used though for acute gout. All right. So any questions about this? About how these drugs act at this point? All right. Well, now we got this little case history. How about somebody reading that for me, please?
A patient with severe congestive heart failure and fluid retention being treated by a T3 intern. On day one, the first intern prescribes furosemide, 40 milligrams intravenously, a diuresis of approximately 700 milligrams of snooze over the next 4 hours. 2 days later, the second intern prescribes furosemide, 40 milligrams by now. Several days later, probenecid started to reduce chronic hyperuricemia, and a few days after, the third intern prescribes furosemide, 40 milligrams by now. How will the effects of furosemide prescribed by the second and third interns compare to the diuresis induced by the first intravenous dose?
Thank you. So let's deal with the second intern. What's the difference between interns one and two with regard to the drug? Route of administration. So what question would you need answered before you could answer the question of what would happen to diuresis? Excellent. Bioavailability is about 61%. So obviously the diuresis is going to be less. So go from 700 to maybe 420 mils. But is the excretion going to be the same? I don't know how to ask this question without giving away the answer. What's going to be different in, if you've got a Foley catheter in and you're collecting urine over this 4-hour period and the total volumes you already know, if you did it every 20 minutes and measured the volume, what would you notice? If you think of an area under a blood curve. Yes. Okay, no, you went too far, but you started out wonderfully. So initial diuresis is not, the peak diuresis will not be as high on oral administration as it would be with the IV dose. But the diuresis will take longer. And so basically, if you think about it, you end up with curves that are, you know, something like this versus something like this. And the major differences in the volumes, this will max out at 700, this will max out, and I know it, my artistic ability is lacking here, but and this will max out at, say, 420. But you got the point. Slower in onset, lower maximum. Okay, then we got the third intern. So the third intern gave a second oral dose. Now what do you expect to happen? Why? Okay. So you expect a lower response over the 4-hour period. But if you were to measure, say, over a 24-hour period, would that dose eventually give you the same diuresis? Just as a first guess. Good guess. Okay. So the second dose is going to be, second oral dose will have, again, lesser of a maximum, a more prolonged effect because it'll take longer for the body to get the drug out of the body. But eventually it will. And it will promote the diuresis that's expected. So very good. You got that. All right. Any questions? Yes, no, maybe so. All right. We'll consider it well done. If we think about a different organ system now, switch over to the lung. We'll start talking about asthma. Asthma affects approximately 10 million Americans, about 5% of all adults are on some kind of medication for their asthma, 7 to 10% of the children. Asthma is a disease that's not a whole lot of fun. I used to listen to a student in class as he rasped from the back of the room. And he wrote this little ditty that's on the handout. About my typical asthma attack begins with slight tenderness behind the sternum. Breathing becomes labored. I take deeper breaths, working more of my upper back muscles. I can sense a slight wheeze in my breathing that can really be felt with a forced expiration. Normally there's no resistance. I may also feel lightheaded. That's a clue to take another hit from my inhaler. Without medication, things can get utterly miserable. On a total lockup, I can't do much of anything. I hunch over and really use those back muscles to get the deepest breath possible. I sit down and zone. My body heats up and just standing makes me extremely lightheaded. Basically, it's a slow suffocation, like sucking on a short tube that slowly gets smaller. I always have my inhaler around. It's negative feedback. And it's not much fun. So for those who have suffered from asthma, I think you can probably relate to that. So asthma, recurrent episodic bouts of shortness of breath, wheezing, perhaps coughing, leads to pale color, bluish fingertips, sometimes even a flaring of the nostrils. So asthma is not a whole lot of fun. Now let's review a little physiology. What do you remember from physiology? Let's see. What's tidal volume? Tidal volume, that's what you just push in and out on normal breathing. Okay? Tidal volume is about 500 mils. Now, Kyle wanted to get into maxes. Let's say you had a maximum inhalation and you blew everything out that you could possibly blow out. What's that? And what does it give you in terms of its overall, there's another term for it, vital capacity, whoever said it. Okay, so that's important. Now, what else is left in the lungs? So there's always some residual volume. Okay, now when you think about getting things out of the lungs, let's say it's a particle. How do you get particulates out of the lungs? You cough, okay. What are you coughing? No, it's not the air that triggers the cough. What is it? Okay, particles on the cilia. What else is on the cilia? Mucus. Okay, so what are you really coughing up? The mucus. Any idea how much mucus you produce in a day? It's about 125 mils. So it's about a third of a Coke can. All right, now how fast do the cilia beat? Now we're getting really trivial. They beat real fast. They're about 200 cilia per cell, and they beat at about 500 beats per minute. And they move mucus at 4 to 6 millimeters per minute. Now that you don't want to know any more details, but that's just some trivia. Okay, why is that important when you think about asthma? Asthma manifests itself in a couple of ways. If we look at the figure there at the bottom, you'll notice that on the left-hand side you've got normal things such as a mucus gland that's producing just a little bit of mucus. You've got a blood vessel that shows that it's has a consistent membrane all the way around. You'll notice that the smooth muscle is more relaxed, and there's a lot of input going to the central nervous system to tell the CNS what's going on in all of this. The CNS is directing things via the vagus and other nerves, but at any rate, what happens if you deal with asthma? Notice that the mucus gland is hypersecreting, so you get excess mucus production. It tends to be a thicker mucus. You can actually get tenacious mucus plugs. And that's a real problem with cystic fibrosis as well. So you get more mucus being produced. What happens to your blood vessels? They tend to dilate out, they become leakier. So now all of a sudden you got fluid building up in the interstitial space, maybe even into the alveoli. And what about the smooth muscle cells? They're all contracted, so that'll narrow the airway diameter. So instead of looking at the figure, if you turn the page, that's what you see. You see edema as a problem. Excess water production. The second thing on the list there, you see excessive production of thick mucus. There often is an increase in the number of goblet cells or mucus secreting cells. The third thing talks about reduced forced expiratory volume. So various factors can trigger contraction of the bronchial smooth muscle, which narrows the airway. And in fact, that's usually measured. So when some of us were dealing with asthma through childhood, we didn't have little gizmos and toys to play with that people have today. You can get what's called a mini Wright peak flow meter. It kind of looks like this. It's kind of pricey. But basically, it works the same way as all the others. You just blow into it. Now, anybody use one of these? $650. Is that good, bad, or terrible? Got any idea? Bingo. You got to know your max. So what are you on a good day? This is allergy season. I usually run about $750. So I'm not too bad today. This is a smaller one, usually given to PEDS patients, but it's more commonly handed out today. Small, cheap, it's only about $30. So asthma is not much fun as a disease, but it's the same thing. You just take an inhalation and blow it and see what your numbers are. So my son, who has asthma, his biggest trigger is viral or cold-induced while exercising, cold weather-induced exercise. But every time he gets a viral infection, he drops from about 700 to about 450. Drives his mother nuts. I grew up with asthma, so it doesn't bother me at all. He can wheeze all he wants to, and I ignore him. It's not that I'm ignoring him, but you know what I mean. She sits in bed, wake at night, wondering if he's going to breathe okay. But the first thing we can do is we can look at this. Have him blow into it, find out what his readings are, and we have a guide by which we use to make decisions as to whether or not to start drug therapy. So this morning, he went on his inhaler. So one of the drugs we're going to talk about are the corticosteroids, and that's what he started this morning. Yesterday, he was puffing on his albuterol. So anyhow, what else do I need to talk about? So there are some places that hand out neat little charts like this. It's an asthma action plan for, and you put the patient's name, put all of your information in there. You've got the green zone and the yellow zone and the red zone. Green is basically your normals. What is normal for this patient? What is good for them? What is the range of normal? You know, you're not going to blow this thing out every time at the same number. So what is the range of normal? In addition, in the green zone, when you've got no cough or wheeze or chest tightness, some people may or may not have meds to take. And if so, what do you take and how much? Some people get into the yellow zone where you're beginning to have some shortness of breath, you're beginning to wheeze, and then you say have some plan. So short-acting beta agonist. How many puffs? How often do you take the puff? And so forth. Schools will harass you. If the school doesn't, the parent will. Because they want this sort of thing on file. Now, the MCCSC doesn't use a nice color-coded thing like this. It's 2 pages long, and it's a nuisance to fill out. And they make you fill it out every year. And if you request that your kid take his inhaler to school and not leave it with the nurse in the nurse's office, which you can do, guess who has to sign that the kid's okay with it? You, the doc, not me, the parent. Which we won't go down that road. But the idea is the kid mature enough, secure enough with their disease that they can take care of themselves? And they know when to take it and when not to take it, and that sort of thing. All the school's really doing is CYA, because it doesn't want the kid to have an asthma attack and precipitate a status asthmaticus and end up having to get the EMTs out, carting them off to the hospital, etc. So that's really where the school's coming from. They don't want anything really bad happening. But in the treatment of asthma, then, you got lots of different options, but almost all of it today depends on knowing what the person's peak expiratory volumes are and what becomes really abnormal and uncomfortable for them. All right. So then the last word on that list is dyspnea. What's that? So it's difficult labored breathing, often associated with hyperventilation. Yeah, shortness of breath contributes to it. So difficult labored breathing. All right. So if you look at this chart on the bottom of that page, you can see that there are lots of ways of treating it. We could talk about this is obviously from an older handout, but you can talk about the ABCs, aminophylline, theophylline, an atropine analog such as ipratropium, antileukotrienes. There's even an antibody that can be used now. And you can see different places where it impacts on the system. And so there are two major effects that you're dealing with in asthma. You're dealing with an inflammatory response as well as a bronchoconstriction. So you're dealing with an inflammatory response as well as a bronchoconstriction. So what about acute asthma? How are you going to treat it? Well, mainstay, beta 2 selective agonists. Now, for those of you that love albuterol, it's an albuterol inhaler. Some people like it. What do you think one of its main side effects is? Well, it might kick the heart a little bit, but that's really not where you really notice it. Especially in kids. You know where you really notice it? What did we talk about with epinephrine? Remember what epinephrine does to the central nervous system? It ratchets it up. You ever want to see ADHD? Just take a 3-year-old, give him a couple puffs of albuterol, and leave him alone in a room. And you'll see how easily it is for a kid to climb the walls and walk the ceiling and have hyperactivity. Anyway, so albuterol is the mainstay in this country for acute attacks of asthma, something where you need an immediate relaxation of the bronchial smooth muscle. So beta 2 agonists are going to stimulate the beta 2 receptor in the bronchial smooth muscle to bronchodilate. That's the mechanism. Turns out there's a secondary mechanism, though, that's important in asthma, and that is that beta 2 agonists inhibit mast cell degranulation. So there's a beta 2 receptor on mast cells and some of the other inflammatory cells, and it inhibits their degranulation, so it stabilizes the membranes. So primary mechanism is bronchodilation. Secondary mechanism is going to be impeding the inflammatory response by preventing mast cell degranulation, preventing the release of mediators like histamine and other things. So here's a whole grocery list of beta 2 selective agonists that are all approved for the use of asthma. One of the things to note is that down at the number E, salmeterol is kind of different from the others. It has about a 12-hour duration of action, so much longer duration of action. You won't see benefits in FEV1, forced expiratory volume in 1 second, until probably 30 minutes out. So it's kind of slow onset, but it's got a much longer duration of action. In contrast, if you take albuterol, you'll see the benefits within a few minutes. So a nice quick response with one, slower but a longer duration with the other. And the other agents are all about the same. Typically with your beta agonists, you're dosing every 4 to 6 hours. Some people say one puff, some people take two puffs, some three, some four, depending on what the need is. And when you think about that, what might you think the biggest limitation to the beta agonist could be? Let's talk about biochemical problem. if you're taking this thing four times a day and you're taking it three or four puffs a day, I heard the word tolerance. What do you suppose the mechanism of the tolerance is? Receptor desensitization. So, you can get receptor desensitization with these things. So, overuse of the beta-2 agonist leads to receptor desensitization. You've already mentioned the cardiovascular effects. We've mentioned central nervous system effects. What happens to blood pressure? We didn't really talk about that too much. Well, if it's a beta-2 agonist, it should vasodilate, pressure might go down. If it's hitting the heart hard and it's increasing cardiac output, then pressure might rise. So, blood pressure may change. And you can't really predict which direction it's going to go in. With usual doses, if somebody's taking a puff or two puffs every 6 hours, it usually will drop a little bit. Okay, so those are your selective beta-2 agonists. Very nice drugs, easily administered by inhalation once the patient learns how to do it. Okay, what else have we got? You got other options. So epinephrine, we've already mentioned. Epinephrine could be used. How are you going to use epinephrine? And what properties are important? It turns out that epinephrine is typically involved in what's called a Krupp cocktail. Now, how many of you have heard of Krupp? How many of you have heard Krupp? Okay, who can bark really nicely and mimic that sound? That's not far off. Not quite, but not far off. Once you've heard it, you won't forget it. It's real, it's just a classic sound. So once you've heard Krupp and that barking like a seal, it's really, it'll just impress itself in your memory, especially if you've got a kid that has it. When does Krupp happen? It's always in the middle of the night. It's never at a convenient time. Can you predict it coming? No. No, you can't. Rob Stone and I had a couple of long conversations about nurses' attitudes in the ED with patient family members bringing kids in with Krupp. A couple of the nurses scolded me one time and I just cut them to shreds. I pulled Rob Stone aside and I said, "You go take care of that woman and I don't want to see her in this room again." Because it was my fault that my kid had Krupp. This woman tangled with the wrong person. At 2 in the morning, you're just not, any rate, it's not cool. So, you know, think about that. If you're trying to communicate with a patient and you're trying to help them through a difficult time, being a little more consoling and helpful and understanding, it's very, very important. Criticizing a dad because your kid's got Krupp is not acceptable. Why is epinephrine useful in Krupp? It's got two major properties that are important. First of all, what is Krupp? What's the cause of Krupp? You got congestion of the epiglottis, for one thing. You got narrowing of the airway, for another. So why would epinephrine be better than a beta-2 selective agonist? Because epinephrine's alpha receptor properties are going to cause constriction of the vasculature and help reduce the congestion. And the beta-2 properties are going to help dilate the bronchus. Yes, sir.
Could you also get a beta-2 selective agent from Krupp?
Could you? Yes, you could. Epi is better because it's got the ability to reduce the congestion. If you've got epiglottal swelling, a beta-2 agonist by itself won't help it. In fact, what will it do to it? Make it worse. So it's really not a good idea. So epi, beta-2 bronchodilator, alpha-1 vasoconstriction decreases congestion. What do you think you're monitoring? Heart rate. It's easier to monitor heart rate than it is blood pressure. Blood pressure usually goes up, but when you're dealing with a small child, I've got a kid who's 13, and when she gets a good respiratory infection, she still sounds croupy at night. You're supposed to outgrow this. Once you get past a certain size, you're not supposed to do it anymore. She still does it. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So yeah, so when the books say you outgrow it, there's another example of the fact that some people don't outgrow it completely. So with epinephrine and croup, you're going to monitor your heart rate. You don't want to get it too high. Another agent that could be given is ipratropium, or another analog, tiotropium. So what is it? They're muscarinic receptor blocking drugs. So you're going to prevent bronchoconstriction from occurring. In terms of breathing emergencies, ipratropium is going to be kind of down on the list. It's more commonly used in chronic asthma or COPD. A lot more use in COPD than asthma. But it can be used. And the rationale for it is it's blocking the constrictive part of the mechanism that controls airway diameter. So the beta agonist is trying to relax it. The muscarinic blocker is trying to prevent constriction. Okay. Then we can also talk about corticosteroids. Prednisone, for example, or methylprednisone. With your corticosteroids, you're inhibiting the inflammatory response. So you're blocking leukotriene B4 synthesis for one thing, other leukotrienes as well. So one mechanism is to inhibit the inflammatory response. A second mechanism is you reverse beta receptor desensitization and downregulation. A second mechanism is that it reverses beta receptor desensitization and downregulation. One of the most common liquids that's given to kids is called Prelone. That's its trade name. And if you read the package insert or anything on the web, the first thing it'll tell you is it's bitter tasting. That's a gross understatement. It's the most foul tasting stuff I've ever tasted. Now, for those of you that like old fashions and you put bitters in your old fashions, take straight bitters. You've never had an old fashioned? Mercy. I'm showing my southern heritage here. Okay. It's bourbon plus a little bit of fruit juice plus ice and bitters. Okay. Anyhow, it's bitter. It's terrible. Why all docs insist on giving it orally. I don't know, because you can do it by injection too. But it always is. I've worn more prelone on my clothes as my kids have spit it out at me because it is terrible. Oh, mix it with applesauce, they'll eat it. Mix it with, yeah, then they hate applesauce for the rest of their lives. I mean, nothing really covers it, you know. I'll never forget going in, and my son often didn't respond. They might have taken the bourbon, I don't know. But I remember talking to Dr. McDaniel, one of the pediatricians at SIP, and my son was on something, and I said, you know, he won't take that stuff. And she looked at me and she said, did you try to taste it? I said, yeah, I tasted it. And she said, yeah, I did too. She said, I opened a bottle the other day. I won't prescribe it anymore. So some of these medicines are really bad. And when it comes to prednisone in an oral base, it is just terrible. Actually, it's methylprednisone, but it's terrible. How do you give it pharmacologically? Short term, typical croup kid, 5 days. And you work hard to get it in them the first day, you work really hard to get it in them the second day, and you kind of quit fighting on the third day. By the fourth day, they're obviously improved, and so you try to get a little bit in them, and if you end up tapering it off, then that's just great. Because with standard steroid therapy, that's what you're going to do. Start kind of high and then taper. Prednisone. There are croup cocktails that contain prednisone and epinephrine, albuterol. Yes, ma'am. Prelone. I think that was, I believe it was BID. I think that was a major fight. The good news is once the kids learn that that nasty stuff helps them, I mean, Kyle brought up a good point. You don't like it. You don't feel good. It's, you know, so once they learn that nasty stuff will help that barking go away and that feeling of I can't breathe go away, once you get them old enough that they can understand that, then they're much better at it. Yeah, I had to deal with croup with all three of mine. So it was just tons of fun.
Don't they have steroid inhalers?
Yes.
Okay. So why wouldn't you just prescribe those instead of the oral? It's terrible.
Because you're dosing at a considerably higher dose to do it. All right. If my memory's right, when you're dosing with a corticosteroid, you're dosing microgram amounts in an inhaler, and you're giving milligram amounts with prelone. So, the desire is to get the dose up. Okay, well, let's take a break here, and we'll come back after the hour, and I'll show you some toys. So, let's continue with some asthma. How do we deal with chronic asthma? Oh, I forgot my spacer. Anybody know what a spacer is? One? Okay, well, we'll talk about it in a minute. Yeah. Let's talk about asthma, chronic asthma. Treated with glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids are very important in the treatment of asthma. They decrease both early and late inflammatory stages. As you can see, if we look at the list below in terms of mechanism of action, there's a lot of things that they do. They can increase receptor responsiveness to beta agonists. They also do some inhibition of the cyclooxygenase. They prevent the release of arachidonic acid from phospholipids, so you inhibit synthesis of all the mediators of inflammation. can stabilize lysosomal membranes. So lots of different ways the glucocorticoids reduce the inflammatory response. The trouble with glucocorticoids is that they are hard to get into a consistent particle size, and many times when you take them in with an inhaler, I don't know if there's anything left in this. All you can see is kind of mist particles with the albuterol. With this one, no, I can't see anything. Must be dead. Well, not what I meant for you to see. I think it's just got propellants left. We'll get into that in a minute with middies. But with the steroid, you usually attach it. Let's just pretend this is a spacer. It looks like a spacer. A spacer is simply a walled chamber. It's about this length. You put your inhaler on one end, and the other goes in the mouth. The purpose of the inhaler is that most of the particulates will actually stick to the side of the inhaler. Less will get into the mouth. Only about 10% of a glucocorticoid dose gets into the lungs. So where's the other 90% go? If you have a spacer, most of it stays in the spacer. There's stuff that does line the oral cavity, and so it's important for patients to rinse their mouth out after dosing. Otherwise, you can get thrush, oral candidiasis. If you start with a nice clear glass spacer, after about three or four doses, you will see all the, it'll look white. It'll get real milky looking. And after time, you just basically, you know, we used to get freaked out and take the thing apart and wash it, get it all clean, put it back together, then we finally quit. Wash it once a year, maybe. So the spacer is really important for allowing about 90% of the particles to deposit in it rather than in the back of the mouth, because only about 10% get down into the lungs. But again, patients should rinse their mouth out after dosing. Okay, another one of the problems with all the oral deposition is you can get ulcer formation. When it comes to chronic asthma, you can see from the list that there are a number of options in terms of agents available. Beclomethasone, flunisolide, fluticasone are big ones. Flovent is, I think, one of the widest of the glucocorticoids that's prescribed. They're now doing some combinations. You can see number F, fluticasone plus salmeterol. So there are combinations, fixed combinations, that are being prepared for patients. They're in the mouth, they're oral ulcers due to the drug. Okay, so when you've got a patient that it has chronic asthma, there's always some kind of hyperactivity of the airway, they are having some shortness of breath, some wheezing at all times, then you would start them on the corticosteroid. So it's the first agent in moderate to severe hyper or severe asthma in patients requiring beta agonists more than once a day. If the corticosteroid is not enough, you've got other things that you can try. Beta agonist being one of the first, but there are other things. So, glucocorticoids. About 90% is deposited in the mouth and swallowed. Oral candidiasis is a problem. Have the patient gargle and use a spacer. Oh, yeah. So just in case you wanted to know, you actually have to write a prescription for spacers and for a nebulizer mask and everything else. So if a patient, I want to breathe easy, comes in and they need a pediatric aerochamber, okay, because no lingo and everything in medicine has to have a nice name, you can put together a script like this. All right. Sorry, I forgot to bring it. I thought I had everything. Okay. What else do we have? I said we had other options. Yes, ma'am. Even if you use the spacer, you should rinse your mouth. It was very important before the advent of the spacers, but it's still important today. Just a different way of having a metered dose provided to your patient. But that brings to mind an important issue. If you read on the label of these things, this says 200 metered inhalations. Patients need to be advised to count their puffs. Keep a record of when they start, when they finish. If they're giving themselves two puffs twice a day, then keep a record of when they started the inhaler. Because what happens is, I told you I thought this one was dead, it feels like it's about half full. And that's just propellant. Yeah, there's probably still some residual drug in there, but there's not much. And so actually, if you weigh one of these things while they're full, and then you weigh them when they get empty of drug, I mean, the companies can do this. They're filled by weight. But the patient needs to count the doses, because if you keep these things for a long, long time, you can be taking all the puffs you want on it, and there's just no drug coming out, but there may be propellants, you know. But this is one of my sons, and it's dead. So placebo effect might be important.
Yeah. Worse than me, I haven't refilled my inhaler for like 4 years. It's still working.
Wow. Let's see. Can I sell you one? Okay. Well, what else is available? There's another group of drugs that are kind of different. Chromalin sodium, netochromal, are two. These guys are different. These guys, turns out, are mast cell stabilizers. They prevent the early and late phase responses, inflammatory responses. They also inhibit IgE-triggered mast cell degranulation. Now, thinking about that, they prevent mast cell degranulation, they prevent IgE-triggered responses. When do you think this drug has to be administered? Prior to whatever triggers the asthma attack. So obviously this would be used for chronic. It would have to be on board before the triggers. If a person, say, always has problems during ragweed season, then you would start them on the 1st of August and carry them on the drug through the end of the pollen season. So prophylaxis of asthma, allergen-induced nasal congestion, lacrimal and ocular hyperemia, allergic rhinitis. These guys have lots of uses. One of the things about Chromalin, brand name is Intal. If I were to do a puff on an Intal inhaler, and you see what little comes out of this thing, but if you were to do Intal, it would be white. It would occlude, well, not totally, but you couldn't see me. Maybe that's a good idea. But there's that much in the way of particulates coming out. Why is that? Because most of it's not absorbed. So it's very poorly absorbed. Poor oral absorption. So if you think of all this particulate dumping in your mouth and you swallow it, it's going to go to the gut. Doesn't matter. It's going to get passed out. Won't be absorbed. If it sits down on the mucus, the mucociliary system will clean it out of the lungs. And again, where does that go after that? Through the GI tract. It's not going to get absorbed. So the great thing about these two drugs is their systemic toxicity is very, very limited. So what do you think the adverse effects might be?
Cough.
Cough, absolutely. Throat irritation. It's kind of bitter tasting, so it can alter your taste a little bit right after you've had it. So typically you'd try a patient for 3-4 weeks, see if they improve. If they do, keep them on it. So it's another group of drugs acting by a different mechanism. They don't affect the dilatory response at all, but they do affect the inflammatory response. Yes, sir?
These are the same ones that put nasal sprays.
Yeah. Yep, yep, yep. So allergic rhinitis, the things that you use in your nose, a lot of chromalins used for that. Okay. What did I do? It's a prophylactic agent. Yes. Oh, one of the things I guess I forgot to show off. Some people have mentioned nebulizers. Let's say we've got a beta agonist. You want these? This is a unit dose for albuterol sulfate. Has a 3 mL dosing. You put it in a little gizmo like this. You can see the liquid in there. You hook it up, and you can get either face masks or you can have your pipe, depending on your perspective. With most kids, you start off with your masks, and some of them actually have straps that you can just strap it to the head. The biggest problem that we had with this was as soon as you kick it on, the sound that comes out of this can freak out a little person. But this is really nice. It's soothing. It's actually nice to reduce a sore throat. Just put water in the thing and vaporize the water and just sit here and breathe it. So, but like I said, you know, once you get to the adult stage, sometimes people would prefer to you know, smoke their pipes. It's a great way to nebulize a drug. Gets in very, very quickly, very nicely. In the middle of the night, when somebody starts having a breathing problem, I kid you not, you can take this off of the closet shelf and have the mask on a child in less than 2 minutes. Everything kind of stays in the unit. It's just very, very simple to use. And once a child gets kind of tuned into it, they'll dose themselves. You know, most people think kids are kind of irresponsible and don't know anything, but in reality, my son was the only one that had to use the nebulizer, and he was doing his own nebulizing from about age 5. when we bought this, and let's see, he was born in 92, so 93, it was $160. This is nothing more than the air pump on your aquarium. So if you know what an air pump on an aquarium costs, then you think about ramping it up for a medical device. But it really, there's really nothing else. What else is there to think about? Anyway, it's pretty simple. And most insurance companies don't like paying for them. But I can tell you, one ER visit and you've paid for it. So I don't know why insurance companies are so stingy. Anyhow. And I guess the other thing that I probably should say is that I think, how do I want to say this nicely? You never want to label a kid as asthmatic. It's bad news for life insurance and things like that. So unless you've got somebody that's really got a major, major problem and you're assuming they're going to grow out of it and things like that, which most kids do, then you just don't want to label them as asthmatic. So if they're having breathing problems due to our, you know, respiratory syncytial virus or something like that, an influenza virus, parainfluenza virus, or, you know, you can give them the beta agonist and the corticosteroid for that purpose, and not put them down, you know, as an asthmatic. Okay, why is that important? Well, it's one of the questions on life insurance. Has a kid ever been diagnosed as having asthma or diabetes or whatever? You'll get asked the same question if you don't have life insurance yet and you decide to go get it. Have you ever had asthma? Yeah, childhood. They'll not worry about it. But if you say you've got it now, you're no longer a cheap risk. Not that you're a cheap risk anyway, but... Okay, so much for that. So much for all these toys. Okay, but I got any other toys to show you? No. Okay. What other drugs are available? The third set of drugs are the methylxanthines. Aminophylline, and theophylline. I can tell you about theophylline. Theophylline is, let's go through it. It inhibits phosphodiesterase, so it increases cyclic AMP, so it mediates cyclic AMP type reactions. In the bronchial smooth muscle, obviously you're going to get bronchodilation. In the heart, you're going to get cardiac stimulation. Increased heart rate, force of contraction, cardiac output, the whole nine yards. A lot of people historically were on the theophylline-type derivatives. It's a great drug. CNS stimulant also. Causes diuresis. Increases some GI secretions and motility. The worst part about these guys is they have a narrow therapeutic index, so it's best to monitor drug levels. You want to keep serum drug concentration below 20 micrograms per deciliter. Do you need to remember that number? No. But the point is, this is one of these drugs where knowing how much is in the bloodstream is important. Knowing what you know about it, what's going to be one of its worst adverse effects? Narrow therapeutic index, life-threatening type thing. Cardiac effects, which kind of cardiac effects? So arrhythmias is a problem. The funny thing about it is some people will suggest to you that the methylxanthines have as much beneficial effect with an ADHD kid as Ritalin does. So if you've got an asthmatic and you put them on a methylxanthine, that'll heighten their ability to concentrate just enough that they're not quite as wild as they could be, which is kind of what Ritalin's doing anyway, or methylphenidate. Okay, methylxanthines, aminophylline. Thing to remember, narrow therapeutic index, major toxicity would be cardiac arrhythmias, but otherwise it's a good bronchodilator. I remember one story of an individual who came in, my wife was saying, complaining that he was just had palpitations, you know, breathing well, but just couldn't sleep at night or anything else. And he was taking Theodore. Now, Theodore is more than just a brand name. It happens to be an extended release prep. You take it once a day. Generic theophylline you take several times a day. And so he was taking it several times a day. So he was well OD'd, and the bottle said once a day. He was told once a day, according to the nurse, because my wife called the office to say, do you realize what this guy's been doing? She told him. She said, you know, I'm not sure if he hurt anybody today. But anyhow, that's the problem with the methylxanthines. Of all the drugs in the treatment of asthma, which ones do you have to worry about? These. All the rest are really very, very good. Okay. The next two on the list we've already talked about. Muscarinic receptor blockers, ipratropium, tiotropium. What do? They block the muscarinic receptor mediated bronchoconstriction. They have no effect on the inflammatory response. So that component of the asthma won't be benefited from it. When can you use it? These guys are used quite a bit, as I said, in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. They do control bronchospasm nicely. They have minimal cardiovascular effects because the amount that's absorbed after inhalation is minimal, or the amount that goes systemic after inhalational administration is minimal. So patients who don't tolerate beta agonists usually do pretty well on these guys. What do you think the biggest side effect is going to be? Dry mouth. So minimal systemic toxicity associated with these guys. So all you're going to get is localized effects, dry mouth, drying of secretions in the bronchus. Okay. The next group of drugs that we could spend a little bit of time on are antileukotrienes. This is an area where there's more and more work being done and more agents that are in process. And so it's a good group of drugs to think about and that are getting more wider use. Why are these guys nice? They can be given orally. You don't have to deal with an inhaler. So now, for those people who just can't seem to get the hang of using an inhaler, you've got another option. Another thing about them. When you think of their mechanism, leukotrienes are involved in the inflammatory response, they're neutrophil attractants, so they're pulling neutrophils into the area. They stimulate bronchoconstriction, increase bronchial muscle reactivity. So even when a patient is asthma-free, because they're an asthmatic, they tend to have a hyperactive airway. In other words, when a trigger hits, they get a major response that a normal person wouldn't really respond to. So the leukotrienes mediate that process. They also increase mucus production. So anything that would decrease leukotrienes in the area would be beneficial. Zafirlucast or Acalate, Montelukast or Singulair, you'll notice that that even comes as chewable tabs. So when they started on the studies of these guys, Montelukast was approved in kids. I think the age cutoff was, I think it's 4 that they got approval down to. Most drugs that you get when the studies are done in adults and they don't have approvals for kids, even though they're used in kids. There weren't studies done in kids for obvious ethical reasons. But in this case, they went ahead and did the study. Let's see. Bioavailability decreases with food, so you would want to advise the patient to not take with food. Take it either an hour before or 2 hours after a meal. They have a high degree of protein binding. They're metabolized by P450, so they have some interactions at that point. So what are they doing? Well, the first two are antagonists of leukotriene's D4 and E4 receptors, or C4. One of the books calls them cystinyl leukotriene receptors. And that would be C4, D4, and E4, since D4 and E4 are actually metabolites of C4. Now that you wanted to know all that. So they inhibit cystinyl leukotriene receptors. They're used prophylactically in the treatment of antigen, exercised, and aspirin-induced asthma attacks. So how many of you knew that aspirin could induce an asthma attack? And how would it do it? No. Aspirin inhibits cyclooxygenase. So if you inhibit cyclooxygenase, then any arachidonic acid metabolism is going to get shunted through the leukotriene side. So all of a sudden, you've got excessive leukotrienes. And there are patients that aspirin can induce asthma in. Zafirlucast and Montelukast are kind of nice. We kind of have to show that they have the routine side effects, you know, headache, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Incidence of those is not very high. There are some drug interactions with phenytoin and with warfarin. The warfarin drug interactions really at the level of protein, well, with phenytoin too, at the level of protein binding more so than metabolism. But these guys are really nice. They block the cystinyl leukotriene receptor, preventing the leukotriene-mediated effects of bronchial hyperreactivity, increased mucus production, and bronchoconstriction. So keyword, prophylaxis. They got to be there before the leukotriene is released. Okay. The other agent that's available is called xylutan. Xylutan is an inhibitor of the 5-lipoxygenase that's present in mast cells and neutrophils. Again, it's going to prevent leukotriene production, but it's acting a little bit higher up in the biosynthetic pathway. Same uses as the others, so that's nice. All the anti-leukotrienes are used prophylaxis and treatment of antigen, exercise, and aspirin-induced asthma. Side effects, getting boring, headache, nausea, vomiting. With xylutan, though, you got something you got to worry about, and that is you can increase liver enzymes. So with hepatic damage, you may see an increase in alanine aminotransferase appearing in serum, or aspartate aminotransferase appearing in serum, or gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase appearing in serum. Evidence of membrane breakdown. So they'd be contraindicated in patients with liver disease, pregnant and nursing mothers. So that's xylutan, an inhibitor of 5-lipoxygenase, so prevents leukotriene production, turns off then leukotriene-mediated responses. The anti-leukotriene drugs must be taken regularly, both when the patient's not having problems as well as when they are having problems. You got to have the drug on board before the trigger. And so that's probably the biggest issue. If an asthmatic is used to taking a hit on their inhaler when they need it and not using it otherwise, once you switch these orally active agents, you've got to give the drug. Yes, sir? No, I just said it's contraindicated in pregnancy and lactation. Just another problem. Okay, let's talk about status asthmaticus for just a minute. What do we know about status asthmaticus? It's bad, okay. The real problem in status asthmaticus is that the airway just clamps. and it clamps so hard that it's very difficult to get an inhalational agent in. Causes can be respiratory infection, under medication, theophylline, termination of glucocorticoids abruptly, overuse of nebulized beta agonist, all kinds of things can trigger it. Acidosis, an allergen, emotional stress. So who knows what the cause? The problem is patient can't breathe. What do you do? The airway is sufficiently occluded that you got to pull out a couple of stops. But the first thing you do is you slap on a mask with oxygen. Why is that? Well, if anything's going to get through and it's 100% oxygen, then it'll be oxygen and that'll help. So you high flow oxygen by mask to reduce hypoxia. The second thing that you do is you hydrate them to reduce mucus plugs. You then begin to nebulize albuterol. If anything can get down that airway, let's get the beta agonist down it with the oxygen. You can also nebulize ipratropium, so let's block the constriction. Now, you got all this stuff going in through the air, and maybe they're not responding and they're not opening up like you want them to. So then you can give a beta agonist, either subcutaneous or IV. So terbutaline, for example, is typically used subcutaneously. But any of the beta 2 selective agents could be used. Epinephrine could be used. Sub-Q, IV, doesn't matter. Steroid, glucocorticoids, prednisone. IV. Can't give it to an IV in a kid. Yeah, I don't understand why we have to fight with prelone, but anyhow. But IV, you got to line in to hydrate the adult, so what else? You can also throw aminophylline at them. You can give that IV. So basically, what have you done? You got a person whose airway is really clamped down. You stick everything that you can nebulize and oxygen in them. So that if you can get the airway open at all, what you're going to give them is going to block constriction, bronchodilate, and give them the oxygen. And then you're going to go systemic with the administration of a beta agonist, a glucocorticoid, or an aminophylline derivative to try to open it up from a systemic perspective. So status asthmaticus is a life-threatening problem. And you're throwing it all at them. Yes, sir?
Why did you say you didn't give a steroid or glucocorticoid?
Huh? I was just making fun of my other comment that, you know, when you got croup, they never give it by injection, they only give it by mouth. I don't understand that one. You don't need to worry about it. So in status asthmaticus, you got two things going on. What are they? You're trying to open up the airway inhalationally and systemically. And you're doing both. Sometimes the high flow rate oxygen and a little nebulized beta agonist will work. Sometimes you got to throw everything at them. But status asthmaticus is life-threatening. Often the patient may not be responsive to inhaled agents. All right. Anything else? Okay, thanks.